Welcome to the Hollywood Outsider, an award-winning weekly entertainment podcast. On this episode, we're going to debate exactly when theaters should reopen, reviews of Becky, Darkness Falls, and Shirley, and our topic this week, what makes a memorable cinematic opening scene. We're going to need a bigger podcast. My name is Aaron Peterson, and joining me today is John Davenport.
Sup, D?
Ow?
Ow, yeah, I would say that. And someone just swove right into a guardrail, be my guess. Amanda Sink as well.
Hello, hello. We're back.
What's up, hoes? We've been gone for a couple weeks, even though people have still got episodes. But yeah, we were gone. It's been nice.
2 weeks off was kind of nice, yeah.
Glad to be back. I think it's pretty exciting. We've got some cool news, I think. California's going to resume filming this very week, so we might be on the cusp of saying adios to our dry spell, but I wouldn't get, you know, too excited. Some of the new production guidelines are a bit loopy, so making out will be odd, seeing that the Film Editors Trade Association is suggesting that close contact moments be rewritten, abandoned, or receive CGI fixes, which means all guys with a Napoleon complex are going to be pretty happy.
This is a very weird transition, but I would also like to say the Hollywood Outsider called it. We called that shit.
Aaron called that shit.
I think I was part of that discussion that called it.
You were part of the discussion. I was part of the discussion, but Aaron was the one going, "Is they're gonna CGI it all? It's okay." So, like, I mean, technically, it is the Hollywood Outsider because it's Aaron, but like, I don't need to get the credit for it. You don't need to get the credit for it.
Oh, I guess we just don't matter.
Wow, jeez.
We kind of, you know.
He said, "You kinda, you know."
we're gone 2 weeks. Don't, no fights.
We're not.
There's no fighting here.
Oh, good. This is like a friendly hug. Sweet.
Yeah. Aww. It's a friendly reminder of who matters the most.
I am not Babe Ruth. Us. I pointed. I called it.
Right.
Don't say who mattered. Don't say it. Don't say who mattered most. Well, I mean, say it one more time.
Who matters the most? Okay. Not us.
Stop it. All right,
stop
keep going.
It, but really his heart's it. Like fluttering.
He's all like, "Yo, you're flirting with me now." Stop it. About getting too excited too soon.
Anyway, what do you guys think about this? Like the idea that we're going to get some CGI sex scenes, if they're going to have any at all. I really feel like love scenes are going to be completely different for at least a year.
Yeah, it's going to be a lot of a lot of catching, trying to find that person, trying to get that person, and then they're resisting you. There's going to be a lot of resistance for a while. And if they do CGI it, I really hope they don't expose which ones are doing it, because then it's just going to be Henry Cavill's mustache all over again. And I can't handle that in this year. We've had enough. We don't need another mustache.
We've talked about this a couple of times. I think we had a discussion on one of the Patreon episodes about whether or not sex scenes are as big of a deal as they used to be. Mm-hmm. And the sex scenes just don't happen the way they used to anymore. If anything, they're more hinted at anyways, because there's just no point in doing any sort of heavy sex scenes anymore, because that's not why people go to the theater anymore. They don't really go like, "Oh, I can go see boobs. It's going to be okay."
Yeah, it,
like,
now you can Google it.
Now you can just Google it and you'll be okay. So that's why the content's so much different. So if they do it, I'd much rather see them do something where they just they hint at what happened the night before, because we don't need a whole 15-minute love scene in the middle of a movie for no good reason. And most movies are better for not having it.
Hold, please. Margot Robbie and The Wolf of Wall Street, I would prefer that was in the movie because it's the best part of the movie. So, I mean, there are moments that I'm okay with.
Okay, moving on from Aaron's creep factor.
I mean, I really appreciate the creep vibe being on Aaron's side at the moment. However, he's not wrong.
But what if they just, like, one of them wore a green suit and then they CGI'd them in? Because then they're covered, they're protected, right? Or they both wear the green suit.
That's just ridiculous.
Those would be, like, pretty thick green suits, and then those poor actors would just, like, be sweating in basically a full-body condom.
And we all know actors are a little egomaniac. for a large portion of them are narcissists, or a section of them. I don't want to say a large portion. Many are wonderful people. There is a section that are narcissists. If you start CGI and body parts onto an actor, and you know some things are not as big as they would like them to be, you're going to be having some Boogie Night vibes where you're like,
well, they could still get the image of them without the green suit too, but then just to be able to compile the, I don't know how it would work.
You guys are digging way too deep on this and not nearly as deep as some of these people you're describing. So, you know,
that's fair. You know what? Let's talk about something that does affect us. And we do have a say in, although not in my current state, not in Illinois, but in other states. You do. Florida, you do.
Florida,
where John is, lots of say because they're like, they're the Wild West there, man. They're like, just open it up. Let's go.
We've been the Wild West for a long time.
Well, I mean, half your population is from that time period, so that makes sense.
Right.
So the National Association of Theater Owners, NATEU, unfortunate acronym, represents 68,000 screens in 99 countries, and they are tracking theater reopenings around the world. On that basis, per a NATEU spokesman, for I think it was Business Insider was where the interview is given. They expect 90% of theaters worldwide to be open by July 17th, which is the date still set for Warner Brothers' release of Christopher Nolan's Tenet. So here's what we're going to talk about. We're going to talk about the theater reopening experience and the experiment that's about to happen, and when we think theaters should open, and try to take our passion out of it and just be realistic for when is a good time. You know, because we're scientists. We're experts. I feel like this is one topic we can be experts about, kind of. So let's talk about it. When should theaters open, legitimately open, in your opinion?
Yeah, this is an interesting topic because Aaron, you already alluded to it. We have so much emotion built into this conversation where I, of course, want to be like 100% reopen it tomorrow. And whoa, I'm buying a ticket every single day. But okay, that's not realistic.
But what, yeah. I mean, okay, we can agree on that. John, I think, he's like, I'm good with a couple weeks.
Well, he's had everything. So he's had the option. And it's nice to have the option.
I mean, my theaters are open right now at 50%. However, they have nothing to show. And then on top of that, my favorite theater, which I talked about ad nauseum about, they declared bankruptcy. So I can't even go to that theater. So and their website is completely down. And right now there's no telling whether or not it's one of those restructuring bankruptcies or if it's a completely out of business bankruptcy, because they haven't been very clear as far as that in the reporting of it. But it's kind of scary. But I checked my movie times and I got nothing to go see. So even at 50%, there's nothing really available.
Okay, so let's talk about legitimately, Amanda. Like, what do you think legitimately?
Right. I think there's a way for you to reopen at a gradual capacity increase. Now, you can start with some of the smaller theaters that might, where it's beneficial and feasible for them to do it and still profit from it. And, you know, there's AMC, unfortunately, is not at the, they're probably not at the right place to be able to be one of the testing sites, if you will, for that increased capacity. But it's something that I hope has been in the works in terms of researching the best practices. And I've heard some rumors floating around that there have been individuals, probably from NATO and associated with them, that have a whole guideline in place. And so if you're able to require masks, you require social distancing, you have a cleaning crew that cleans every day and periodically throughout the day, you limit the seat capacity, and not just the capacity, but distancing. You know, if you say, okay, we're going to take all of the seats, one seat around each way or two seats around each way from each group, including back and front, then you're limiting it in terms of that, but you're also spreading people out. And there's obviously going to be a huge demand. You're probably going to see a little bit of an increase in concession prices, which I'm okay with. And there's ways to do that in a slow process. It's not like you say the movie theaters open tomorrow and everybody gets to go in. That's not feasible. You know, if you pre-purchase your tickets and that's how you're required to be able to even get into the building, and then maybe they just don't take cash payments. You know, they can scan your ticket to enter the building, and maybe that's how they do it. And so I think there's a way for you to do it. And it's really hard because you don't want to discount all of the people who have health conditions that could be affected by people who go to the theater, are asymptomatic, and then encounter other individuals who are very at risk. And it's hard to say just stay at home if you're required to go to work or if you have to go to the grocery store and whatnot.
It's pretty easy to say that if you're going to a movie theater. If you don't want to go or you don't feel safe or you're high risk, stay at home.
Well, I think it's feasible to just say don't go to the theater, but you could still be impacted by your neighbor, your colleague going to, you know, in John's case, he's at work.
Hey, Bob,
every day.
Did you go to the theater? Sure did, Jim. Stay away from me. Thank you.
You know, but I'm hoping that we're able to start bringing it back, because not just because it's something that's obviously close and personal to all of us, but because an entire industry sector could collapse into the ground if something isn't done to be able to help these theaters. And, you know, there has to come a point that we've gotten enough research and information at this point, I would hope, to be able to say this is the best procedures and these are the best practices to move forward. You know, if you can have a dental office, and
man,
I know
it's been 5 minutes. We got to.
Oh, my God. I'm sorry. Okay. Cut me off. I have so many thoughts. I'm sorry. It's been so long since we recorded.
Can you leave some thoughts for the rest of us, maybe?
I'm sorry. Thanks for timing me.
Let's try this. Okay. Let's try this approach. Let's take it. The theater experience as it goes. So buying the tickets. Okay, this is what I think you can do. Let's just discuss. You can do most of that automated, right? You can buy your tickets online.
Well, you can buy the tickets online through Fandango. You can in the Fandango app, you can actually bring up the ticket stub. So there's a little scan bar on there that you walk up and they can scan it. So there's no touching there. There's no handing of a physical ticket to anyone. Just use more theater apps, so an AMC app, a Fandango app, stuff like that to make sure it's touchless.
And you could probably require guests wear masks until they're seated or something, at least until they're seated.
At the very least. And then also, if you, depending on the capacity, you're not allowed to buy any more than two tickets at one time.
I could see
that. Well, people would have a fit if it's like two parents and then they want to bring their two children or something.
Okay, four, or there's exceptions for parents. I mean, if they've got like four kids and they just decided to keep
two parents and family.
Two adults, you know, and if the purchase process is two adults, two children, then then they're automatically can be put together in a spot.
Okay, so there you go. You're in the theater. This seemed easy enough so far. Now you get to concessions, right? Because you want a little snackaroni. I would say, here's what I thought. The cashier wears gloves. Everybody wears gloves, but different people get you the food than take your money. Because, you know, when you're wearing gloves and you're going through all the different money, that's different hands.
Or just do cashless. Most of them have the ability to take your card with the slide or the insert.
I guess. But some people are going to come with cash. And, I mean, they don't want to turn that money away because they need every dollar. But I guess you could require it, sure.
Or limit it. You know, preference is to use card if possible. And, you know, if you encourage it. At least if you're not taking it in two different areas, you're not taking it in box office. Or you could pre-purchase your concessions. It would be more difficult.
It'd be harder for especially smaller chains because they would have to develop that. They don't have time to develop that technology.
They've had a lot of time to develop it.
They got to have money too. They're not making money. It's hard to
I understand.
Invest in that. You get your own drink, right? They hand you the popcorn, no refills, or if they do, you wear gloves, but you get your own drink, but you use the knuckle approach. You know what the knuckle approach is?
Yep.
Use your knuckle, not your fingertip when you're selecting your drinks.
So this has actually been, I was speaking with a friend who's a manager at a movie theater, and this was her biggest concern, is keeping those like freestyle type machines as clean as possible with people having to do it by themselves.
Yeah, that's next to impossible.
Exactly. And that was the point. Yeah. And so they've already, a lot of them that have the freestyle, they already removed all of the syrup pumps from, and replaced where the fountain soda on the back end in the concession area used to be. A lot of them, not all of them, but a lot of them have, when they get the freestyle machine, they've just basically said, this is an opportunity for us to have more in the back end. And so they wouldn't have an alternative unless they just had somebody who like, ordered up the drinks and they somehow put that behind in the concessions behind. them if they have the space. So that way the employees are now filling up the freestyle versus people putting their hands or their knuckles or whatever.
I'm good with the knuckle approach. I took it before and I just washed my hands before I would eat anything. Even if you didn't, it's just on, it's your knuckle. It's not your fingertip. So it's not getting your knuckle in there.
Unless you cough in your hand.
Yeah. I'm a little dubious of this knuckle approach. There would have to be an attendant there at the freestyle machine to do everything for you who's gloved up and ready to go.
Yeah, that's another approach.
You don't think that people should do it themselves currently?
No, because you want to limit how many people are touching that machine. So the only way to really do that is to make sure that you have an attendant doing it.
Mm-hmm.
Like the freestyle machines are great, but now they're problematic because they're something, they're all touch screens, and knuckle approach is fine and dandy, but once you have a living creature put attached to your skin, it's not like it stays in one point in your skin. It just starts to move around.
You wipe it on your jeans, John. That's what you do. You wipe the knuckle on your jeans. COVID gone.
Okay. This is risky. The germaphobe, I'm very surprised, is the one who is proposing this.
I live my life a quarter virus at a time. That's what I do.
Quarter virus at a time, he says.
Okay, fine. They do it. It's 2-1, so you guys win. So they do the drink. You don't touch the drink. Fine. Whatever. I got to let little Hector do it. Little Hank and little Jim, whatever the hell their names are.
Tanner. His name is Tanner.
Okay, I let little Tanner do it. And then we go and we sit down. And, you know, Amanda, in her soliloquy, said something about like a seat empty on each side of whatever group.
And behind and in front.
I could see that. I think that would actually work.
Box like, it in.
Yeah. Basically, you got seats all the way around. I mean, that should control the environment.
Yeah, they would have to close every other row.
You know, I don't think you have to do the whole row, though. I mean, what she's saying is like you've got...
No, you could spread it out.
Empty seats... like behind them, in front of them, and just one seat on the corners, and I think you're good, right?
And I will say that at least for some theaters, prior to them all shutting down, had implemented like a social distancing already in the pre-selection.
Yeah, they were already working on it.
Yep, so they had it implemented. So they would really, because I think they just had it more horizontally, so left and right of you. But if they implemented it vertically too, basically just boxing around the ones that were selected, it would eliminate people being too close, and you would just have to buy all of your tickets at once. And then hopefully people would be responsible in terms of like, I'm going to grab all 8 of my best friend groups and we're going to take up, you know, as much possible as we can.
Yeah. Well, I mean, they'd
have a limit on ticket.
They'd have to control it. So, I mean, we can agree on that. So therefore, like, it doesn't seem like it's very complicated that we agree on anything. And also demand all cell phones are turned off before the lights go down, just, you know, for safety.
Right. Because cell phones have that 5G, and the 5G transmits the virus quite quicker.
Done. That works. You should put that on screen. Half the people probably believe it. Like, oh, right. Man, I knew it. So far, like, I really think that would work, and I don't know why they can't do that. I know some places are hesitant, but I saw several scientists, I think it was Michigan, put together this chart of, you know, on a scale of 1 to 10, what are the most dangerous things to do for, you know, the current pandemic? Movie theaters, you know, they're rated about a 6, which is about midway. And bars are number 9, but bars are already open in most states. So apparently that's a priority, but theaters aren't a priority. And that's, to me, that's a good escape for people to get away from all the stress and whatnot they've been dealing with for the last few months. So that gives them an opportunity to go out and enjoy it a little bit. I don't know why some states are just adamant against it for now.
I know that part of it has to do with, and this is in a lot of different environments, the circulation of the air.
Mm-hmm.
But, and it is an expensive
task. Hold your breath.
Well, you know, when we watched Outbreak, that scene in the movie theater where the one dude starts coughing and, you know, his spittle starts going all the way up into the air and then hits the fans and the fans spray it back down on everybody. You know, that's all things that are legit, you know, possible happening. So, yeah. I get why.
That's literally the only thing in that movie that's possible. Just so you know. I mean, just to clarify, everything else could not happen the way it happens.
Are you trying to, like, tell me I'm wrong or agree with me?
No, I'm agreeing with you. I said, thank you for, you basically canceled my argument.
Right.
Which is great. But I just want to point out the movie itself, that's literally the only thing that's correct in that whole movie, because you can't develop a vaccine in 14 minutes. You just can't do it.
Or we would already be like out having the movie theater party right now.
Exactly. Did you get it?
But they can get these air filtration systems installed, but that is so costly. Like, that's what a lot of the dentists and like medical personnel had to do to reopen. And it's a huge cost. So I don't see movie theaters being able to take on all of these costs, including trying to, unfortunately, you know, try to outbid other places to get this, you know, safety equipment and stuff that they would need to protect themselves and other employees and customers.
What I've loved is seeing the outcry from people that are, they prefer to stay home, which is fine. Hey, if you prefer to watch it at home or video on demand or streaming or whatever, that's awesome. But they're just like, yeah, yeah, yeah. I'm like, you're cheering a whole industry to go down just because you don't want to leave your house? That's weird.
Yeah.
It's an odd choice.
It's weird. But this is how we get, you know, innovation gets introduced into a stagnant system.
I bought a projector, and I'm going to project movies on my fence. I'm going to give it a shot anyway. I mean, I'm just trying something new. I can't go to a theater yet, so I want to at least try to have the experience in my backyard, essentially. So, I mean, there's different ways people are trying. I heard a friend of mine is doing it with a garage door. He got a projector, and he's projecting on a garage door. Another friend got an inflatable screen, and he's doing backyard. He's trying to recreate outdoor experiences for his kids. These things are awesome. We're getting innovative in this time.
My brother-in-law has an actual movie theater room.
How big's the screen?
Like your average, like, rooms, because it is a projector, so it's at your average like giant room. So
the whole wall is
the screen.
Nice. Does he need a roommate?
he's already got two kids and a wife, so no.
Does he want a third kid?
Really?
No.
Probably not.
He's actually your age, so no.
Oh, does he want a sister?
Are you this desperate? I mean,
just want a movie theater room or a movie theater. I can't even get to the drive-in, man. I did have one experience, but around me here, they are just like sold out, sold out, sold out, sold out. Or you have to get there at like 1 o'clock in the afternoon, apparently.
I did that. I went and saw Jaws and E.T. you know, at the drive-in, and half, you know what was really cool though, is half the attendance was not allowed in. So you only got half the cars normally. And you got, each car got their own section.
Mm-hmm.
So you didn't have to share. You didn't have to be all tight with somebody. You got to have your own section, get roomy. You could park your car crisscross if you wanted to. Just be a rebel. Loved it.
In other forms of entertainment that it's going on, there's actually a comedian, Bert Kreischer, who's going on tour this summer to movie theaters. And that's where he's going to do his stand-up, is at movie theaters. Interesting.
That's cool.
Drive-ins.
I got it. Yeah, I figured since we were talking about outdoor theaters, I figured that's what you meant.
Yeah, I know. I know I forgot to say the word drive-in. I said movie theaters, so that's why I was correcting myself.
I appreciate that.
They're hosting some graduations on screen, too, which I thought was really cool for kids who weren't able to see their graduation or experience it.
I don't know. That drive-by graduation thing seems pretty fun.
It's not. It's not. My buddy Amanda knows. I was telling her this. I think I told you this too, right, John?
Uh-huh.
My buddy's daughter graduated, and it was pouring rain, and she's sitting in a driveway just sopping wet while people are driving by going, congratulations, and we're all comfortable in our cars going, congratulations. She's like, hey, thanks. Downpour, thanks.
That sucks.
Screw you, COVID.
As somebody who doesn't like those things, it would be great for me to be like, yeah, sure, I'll show by. And I'd be going, driving by the fastest speed possible, you know, zipping in and out of the traffic just to get it all done. Yeah.
I guess we can all admit it is nice to not have to worry about what time is okay to leave.
Right.
That part's good. I didn't say, you know what? He doesn't listen to this. It's fine. It'll be all right. Okay. I think we got that solved. You know what? Let's move on to You Can Do It. This is where each host takes a movie they genuinely do not like and find a legitimately positive element to it. What we're trying to do here is bring positivity back to the world. It's sorely lacking. Everybody's fighting about everything for the last 3 months. I feel like it's just difficult for us to be positive anymore. So we're trying to be positive. So take something you don't like, be genuine, not snarky, and find something that you do like about it. Amanda? I feel like I cut you off from your monologue, so why don't you go first?
Why don't I start another one? Yeah. I'll be fair.
Yay!
Don't tune me out.
New phone, who dis?
Hey.
Sorry. Just kidding.
So I chose Mandy, and no, this is not my nickname. Don't ever call me this. In the Pacific Northwest in 1983, outsiders Red Miller and Mandy Bloom lead a loving and peaceful existence. When their pine-scented haven is savagely destroyed by a cult led by the sadistic Jeremiah Sand, Red is catapulted into a phantasmagoric journey filled with bloody vengeance and laced with deadly fire. Now, you've heard our thoughts. I think Aaron and I had talked about it.
You felt like you had to go through that whole synopsis for that garbage movie, huh?
I just want, in case people hadn't seen it or didn't know what it was about, okay? I was just trying to be nice.
I appreciate that. There's a chainsaw battle. That's pretty sweet.
There is a lot of cool action scenes. I will tell you that the things I did enjoy in this film all revolved around Nick Cage's performance, because he was bold and vicious. I mean, he was Nick Cage, okay? So he was a little crazy and wild. But it was really fun to watch him be fully immersed in this weird, wild role. I mean, like, very strange. But I really loved it. Like, I felt like he did such a great job, and I just didn't care about the rest of it. But that didn't take away from his performance, and he had some really cool scenes. Like, the chainsaw scene that Aaron mentioned was super rad. So,
would you say that he was uncaged?
Get out of here. Please go away. You've been saving this up.
There are several moments where he is pretty fantastic. That one scene where he's just covered in blood and he's just screaming. And it's like, I want to be Nick Cage for a while. That's a cool actor right there. He's a cool dude.
There's a really cool scene that I think is in the trailer where he's sitting on the toilet. That sounds weird. It looks better than I'm making it sound.
I hope so. I don't remember this.
You don't remember where he was just like so like just
distraught,
broken and quiet. Yeah, distraught. And he's just sitting, and then you realize he's sitting on the toilet, and it's very bizarre. But his
we've
face,
all been there.
His literal face reaction and expressions were like kind of powerful. So I give him good credit for this film.
All right, John, what about you? What's your You Can Do It?
So my You Can Do It is a little movie called In the Name of the King, a Dungeon Siege story. Now, if you don't know what this is, it's okay. You're not supposed to know what this is, because it was a UA Bowl movie, and it was supposed to be like one of these video game adaptations, and it failed on every single front. But what it does really, really good is apparently bribe actors with like naked pictures or something to be in a movie. So like the cast you got working with you on this is like Jason Statham. I think this is the movie that actually murdered Lily Sobieski's career. John Rhys-Davies, Ron Perlman, Claire Forlani, Christina Loken, same thing, same murder happened of a career right there. Matthew Lillard, and Burt Reynolds, Ray Liotta. I mean, that sounds like I just drank something that made me insane. And to watch all these people on this screen make this movie was, as much as it was a painful experience watching the movie, these people sold it. Like, they sold every single bit of why you should be watching them. It's a bad movie, but it's so much fun just watching them. I still don't suggest actually watching the movie, but if you have to, they're worth it. At least for about 5 minutes. And if that's not worth it for you, then watching all the costumes of like the orcs and everything fall apart mid fight, not like, oh, that's battle damage, more so like, hey, that's actually a glove, and they didn't even seal up the glove for that monster hand all the way up the guy's arm. I can see the rest of his arm. That kind of crap. So, yeah, it's that's my movie.
That's very much a movie similar to The Room in many ways, where if you're with a group, it's actually kind of fun to watch, but only with the right group.
I was going to say I did not have that experience.
See, I started watching this with my wife, and at about 15 minutes in, she said, F this, I'm out. And she left me in the living room all by myself to watch it. And at that point, I was already like, I'm in. So,
did you finish the movie?
I can't stop.
Good for you. All right, well, I'm going to pick a popular one, okay? Because this is a movie I don't like. I just don't like it. I don't like The Shining. I can't stand it. I hate it. I don't say hate very often about a movie because usually I try to find something, but that one is just something that just sours me completely on many, many fronts. As an adaptation, I really love the book and it fails there. And as a movie on its own, it's just way too campy for me. So I'm not a fan. To me, the camp loses all the meaning of the story and, you know, all that stuff goes together. But one thing I love and I can acknowledge is the imagery from Stanley Kubrick and John Alcott, who was a cinematographer. Absolutely, utterly stunning. It's a beautifully shot film. It is very eerie, very haunting, the way they amplify the horror of insanity in certain moments. Like anything in the hallway is beautifully shot. The way the camera makes a character out of the Overlook Hotel even kind of brings a... There's even like a haunting loneliness when they're trapped inside the maze, when they're lost in the maze. So the camera work to me was absolutely top-notch. If I would have enjoyed the story, and honestly, Jack Nicholson's performance a little bit more, I think, and I know people are like, what? He was so good. I didn't like it. Didn't like Shelley Duvall either. She just, her voice killed me. It's just not a movie I love, but I love the visual cues and the shots and the framework and just everything about it in terms of visuals, I think is stunning.
That's a good argument for it. And I'm proud of you.
Thank you.
That shows some growth.
So then it's well known that I don't like that movie. Okay.
No, I honestly had no idea today. This is the first time I'm hearing of it.
Shock and awe right now.
This is feeling I'm like sarcasm. I don't like sarcasm. It's very overrated. You know what?
I don't speak sarcasm.
Our show is independently funded. Therefore, all the expenses are from our own pockets, and Patreon helps fans support their favorite podcast. We realize it's been hard for many people because of what's going on. It's, you know, we're not demanding anything, but if you can help, it does help the show. We do appreciate it.
We are.
Yes, we're demanding. Once you sign up, you get immediate access to all the content in your respective tier. Hundreds of hours of bonus content is there if you sign up for the right tier. Next up, we're actually looking at a classic franchise. We're going to look at Back to the Future. Why do we still love the series? Why are we talking about it 30 plus years later? Now that you understand what this is, if you want to support the show, go to patreon.com/TheHollywoodOutsider. That's patreon.com/TheHollywoodOutsider. And you can get immediate access today. Now, we've got 3 spoiler-free reviews. Won't be too long on these. We're going to get to the topic here in a minute, but let's talk about 3 movies that we just saw. The first one up is Becky with a surprising supporting performance.
All right. So spunky and rebellious Becky tries to reconnect with her father during a weekend getaway at a lakefront house, but the trip soon takes a turn for the worse when convicts on the run, led by the merciless Dominic, suddenly invade the home. Johnny, you saw this, and it's a pretty popular movie for watching right now, but it sounds it's not the best pick for Father's Day.
Oh God, no, because that description has it completely wrong, because she is not interested in reconnecting with her father at any way, shape, or form. Or she's a little a-hole, and she starts the movie as an a-hole, and there's brief moments of where she's not an a-hole, which is kind of sweet and cute, but that's mostly in flashback form. But she's pretty much like, I hate everything and everyone.
Good to know. All right. So tell me about this secondary performance that is stunning and powerful. Is this not Kevin James?
Oh, it's absolutely Kevin James.
Okay.
Becky's cute and everything. And Lulu Wilson does a great job as Becky, but it's Kevin James's movie. If he comes in, he's got the shaved head, which we've never seen him do anything like that, this big beard, and he's just wearing the bulk of a man who likes to eat and fight. And he is very intense, and he doesn't do anything that is menacing in the sense of like very cartoonish. No, he's menacing in that quiet way, that way that you know you really messed up when that person's talking to you. And it's just incredible when he's doing it.
I would have never pictured or imagined that, because I've always seen him in like a comedic role.
Does Adam Sandler pop up?
No.
Like a weird cameo?
Adam Sandler does not show up, and neither does Rob Schneider.
They're in the corner going, they're all going to laugh at you.
Yeah, it's pretty incredible what he does. And I went down a rabbit hole with Kevin James after this, but yeah, it's really incredible what he does. And it, again, that I can't overstate it enough. That whole scary intensity, like, you know, you ever get in trouble by your dad, and when it's the parts where he gets quiet is when he's the scariest. Mm. It's that kind of intensity to it.
Okay. All right. Well, that sounds really good. Now, I've heard some not so great things on the interwebs, but what? It sounds like that's not your experience. Did you enjoy the gratuitous violence that I am hearing is existing in this film?
That's kind of a double-edged sword, because on the one hand, watching a whole bunch of Proud Boys get their ass handed to them by a 13-year-old girl, kind of fun, you know?
Fair.
You know, watching that, like, a 13-year-old girl knock one in the water and watch the Proud Boy can't even paddle water, and then she ends up killing him that way. Kind of fun. It's but then at the same time, Lulu Wilson is such a small frame girl, and she is so slight, especially in comparison to everything else. You start wondering, how is this even possible? And you have to really bounce back and forth or argue with your suspension of disbelief on this, because there's a lot of times when you're like, okay, this is about to take me out, I'm out, and then it's just Lulu Wilson does something and I'm like, okay, I'm back in. Because it's so hard to believe, but she does a good job of bringing you back into the character and bringing back into the movie.
So if the full price of admission were $10, what are you giving Becky?
I am giving Becky $7.50. I really do. If you get a chance to go see it, watch it. It was a lot of fun. The group of people that I watched it with, we all hooted and hollered. It's great with a family or friends. And yeah, it's really a good time.
Awesome. Wow.
Kevin James. And he has the number one movie in the country right now, because there's nothing playing. So he's got number one. Go, Kevin James.
Go, Kevin James. All right. So, Amanda, on Hulu, you watch Shirley. So, Shirley, for those who don't know, a famous horror writer, Shirley Jackson. Yes, that Shirley Jackson. And if you don't know what that means, I'm really sorry, because I mean, you should know by now. Finds her inspiration for her next book after she and her husband take in a young couple into their home. This is directed by Josephine Decker. And so I read that description. I watch the trailer. And I get the feeling that this movie takes a lot of inspiration, as far as at least the way they tell the story, from a lot of her books, does it?
Yes. Yeah, so it's definitely trying to invoke her very dark and dour and just horrific elements that she always put into her books. And it's in the midst. So part of it is true. Most of it would be true. But there's parts of it that are fabricated just for the dramatic flair. But when you talk about Shirley as a character, most of that is real. And so you kind of get to understand, if you didn't know much about her, you get to really understand the plight that she was on, and maybe why and how people were just so just discontent with her as a person at that time, and why her work wasn't revered until much later. And so you really get to see kind of some of the psychological twistings that she's going through.
I didn't mention this, but Elizabeth Moss stars in this. And when I was watching the trailer, what I really see is that there's a lot of acting and swinging to the fences that feel almost a little melodramatic, which to me is something that actually turns me off a little bit. So can you, or are you even willing to suggest to me or give me reasons why I should watch it?
There are a lot of things that are working for this. If you're a fan of Shirley Jackson, I would say that this is still an interesting movie for you. If you're somebody who doesn't like the very, almost like a dreamy aspect, because again, they're trying to pull you into almost like a level of psychosis and have you visualize some of the things that she's dreaming about or some of the things that she's feeling. And she's very, I would say Elizabeth Moss as an actress with this character is a bit more over the top than I would have expected. She still does well, but it's nothing compared to some of the work that she's done before in Handmaid's Tale or even in Invisible Man. She was so stellar in some of this previous work that honestly, my expectations may have been too high. And I was not, and this could just be me, I was not a fan of her accent, the way she spoke. And it's not even really an accent. It's just the way that she spoke. It felt like she was trying so hard to emulate this character, this person, and it just kind of detracted because it felt forced. But to go to the film, it does lack in a lot of places. I would, though, if you're interested in Shirley Jackson, it's still a good opportunity for you to understand how she came to the story of Hangs a Man, because she's writing it in this film, and understand the very just dark relationship and toxic relationship with her husband, and to understand that while she was very talented and inspirational in terms of a horror writer and how much she has genuinely done for the horror community as a writer, she's not the best person, but she's also dealing with a lot of mental issues. I'll say that.
Does this movie take place after The Haunting of Hill House or before, after she wrote that?
I believe it's before Haunting of Hill House because it's after the lottery.
Okay.
Which they mention in this one. And then it's while she's writing Hangs a Man. Because I believe that Haunting of Hill House came out in the late 50s or early 60s. And so this is taking place just before that.
All right.
Okay. All right. So what, if you were to give this a score, what kind of score would you give it?
I'm going to go 550.
Right. Okay. 550 it is. Aaron, you saw a different movie. See, I'm not used to talking this much, so it's going to be weird.
It's
so
true. Normally we should keep you shut. We don't like John Reed too much, you know?
Right.
He's doing so well. So
you got this, I know.
Yeah, I'm doing pretty great. I actually almost made that transition great if I didn't interrupt myself. So you saw Darkness Falls. It's a recent release. After his wife's suicide, Detective Jeff Anderson becomes convinced that she was murdered. Obsessed with his investigation, he finds out that his wife was a victim of a team of a father and son serial killers, and he sets out to stop them. It's directed by Julian Sarri and written by Giles Doust. And these two guys are nobody I know, and with the exception of The Man Who Killed Hitler and then Bigfoot, which is a bonkers movie in itself, I have no idea what to expect from these guys. So stylistically, and this sounding like sort of like a revenge detective thriller, like, what am I looking at here?
Okay, so, well, one thing I want to tell you, that two of the guys, it's funny, I didn't realize until after I'd watched the screener, I'd already watched the movie, I'd already put my opinions together and everything else, and then I saw that Luke Barnett and Vincent Maselli were producers on this movie, and they did Faith Based, which I reviewed before, and also Fear Inc., which we had them on the show, you know, a couple of years ago. So that was kind of that's a fun coincidence. But now I completely forgot what your question was, because I was just talking about our show.
So my question was, based off of like who the director and writer are of this, who are people that I don't recognize, the only thing that I know of is The Man Who Killed Hitler. Stylistically, what should I expect from this movie?
It's okay. Here's the one thing I will say. This is very much the kind of film it sounds like. It is the burned out cop whose wife was taken from him, and he's desperate to find her killer, but nobody believes that there is a killer. They do believe it was a suicide, and he's, you know, he's scratching his responsibilities as a father. He's just kicking everything to the wind in the search for these murderers. He doesn't know how to prove that there's actually serial killers out there, that there's two people out there killing women and making it look like suicides. So he has to put this, so it very much feels like that kind of film where you have the cop that's just burned out and he's grizzled, and you know, the next time you see Sean Ashmore after his wife passes away, he's got the full beard and he, you know, he looks unkempt, and he shows up to his former partner, now captain, to ask for assistance, and she's like, you haven't been a very good cop for the last couple, you know, probably not a great example right now. But he's that kind of cop. He's obsessed with his wife's case. He's trying to find out who these killers are and find a way to prove it. So that's the kind of movie it is. And I like the story a lot, actually. It's a really cool concept. And I love the idea that these guys have been getting away with it from the get-go. And it's not a spoiler, because literally the first scene is what these guys do. So
Okay, so as you mentioned, the cast is held up by Sean Ashmore. Mm-hmm. Gary Cole's also in this as well. These, to me, are a couple of guys who are cool, and they've done a lot of cool things, but they're very much the idea of like an everyman to me. There's like they blend into the environment very well, but how do they do here?
Okay, well, I'm of two mindsets on this. One, Sean Ashmore, I thought, was very solid. He, you know, he's the lead. He's really who we spend most of our time with through the entire movie. Unfortunately, there were a few moments, like, I'm not going to lie, there were a few moments where I was kind of, I thought he was trying too hard. You know what I mean? I just felt like he's trying to be angry and he's acting. You know, there are a couple moments where I thought he did really well for most of the movie, but there are a couple moments when he's really trying to throw outrage or despair or panic, and it just felt like, oh, well, that's acting right there. And that's probably where I struggled most with the movie. I mean, I didn't dislike it at all. I didn't think he was bad in any way, shape, or form, but it definitely makes you kind of go, okay. But Gary Cole, I mean, I will disagree with you, man. I love Gary Cole. Like, blend into the environment.
I didn't say I didn't love him. I just said, like, he blends in. He's also very cool.
He is very cool. And he's a serial killer in this, which is pretty perfect. I don't know if I've ever seen him be a straight-out villain. Well, I guess I have in a couple things. But, like, a real... I mean, he is a dick in this movie. I mean, he is an absolute monster. And he does it so cool. I mean, he's typical Gary Cole. He's just cool. Yeah, I'm going to need to kill you on Saturday. I mean, he's just a cool dude. And his son is played by Richard Harmon. Shut up. That was funny. His son is played by Richard Harmon, who is on the 100. I don't know if you guys ever watched that show, but I like him quite a bit. And it was fun seeing him play the son. I think he has he's John Murphy on the 100. He's just a fun character actor. I think I love him on the 100, and I think he's good here. So those two guys, I think, are good. The only thing is like, they're not in the movie that much. I want more of them. If I would have got more of them, I think this could have been a really good movie. Right now, it's just it's an entertaining film.
Okay. All right. So if $10 full price admission, what do you give it?
$5.50. Same as Shirley. But you know what? It's a fun rental. So if you got an hour and a half to kill, I do like the story. I love serial killer thrillers. Those are like a hot spot for me. Whew. You know what? We got some new releases coming out, and then we're going to get into our topic. First up is King of Staten Island. Comes out on VOD June 12th. Judd Apatow directs. Pete Davidson stars as Scott, who has a case of arrested development since his firefighter dad died, which is actually a true thing that happened to Pete Davidson. His father died in 911. I don't know if you guys knew that or not. He spends his days smoking weed and dreaming of being a tattoo artist until events force him to grapple with his grief and take his first steps forward in life. This is one of those that was supposed to come out in theaters, but now is coming straight to video on demand.
All right, and then on June 12th on Disney Plus, we have Artemis Fowl. Artemis Fowl, a young criminal prodigy, hunts down a secret society of fairies to find his missing father. This is directed by Kenneth Branagh, stars Colin Farrell, Josh Gad, and yeah, that's the movie.
I don't know. I'm kind of weirdly interested in that one. Defy Bloods comes out June 12th on Netflix. Four African-American vets battle the forces of man and nature when they return to Vietnam seeking the remains of their fallen squad leader and the gold fortune he helped them hide. Mm. And this one has basically the leader is Chadwick Boseman, but it doesn't sound like if they're looking for his remains that he's going to be too much part of the film. But this one's from Spike Lee. So if you're a fan of him, then this might be a good flick for you.
Yeah. I mean, all three of these actually are pretty solid. And I do believe, yeah. Well, except for The Five Bloods was already a Netflix movie. It was already going to be streaming. But Artemis Fowl was supposed to go to theaters too, right? Now it's streaming.
Yep. Yeah, it was supposed to be in theater.
Wow. It's crazy what times have done. Times are done. Open the theaters and these things can be in theaters. Man, that's all I'm saying. Let's go to our From the Outside In topic. What makes a great opening sequence? Okay, that's the discussion. What makes an opening sequence great? What makes the opening of a film cinematically memorable? Any particular kinds of openings that really register with you, or like what gets you go? Is that a term still? I don't know.
I don't know if that's in or out. I'm not hip with the lingo anymore.
I'm pretty sure goat means something different now.
I get really compelled by very interesting action pieces. Like if there's a great set piece in the beginning of the film, I can really engage with, or something that's just utterly shocking. Like if I wouldn't have expected that to happen, like, wow, this is really going to get this film going.
Like a cat jumping out of a cupboard? Unexpected or like actually unexpected?
No, like somebody snipering a child.
Oh,
that definitely goes, wow, okay, didn't expect you to take that leap. You know, when they make really, or sometimes when they have a lead character that they kill in the first 15 minutes, I'm like, wow, you're really going for it.
Oh, it's not an opening sequence. That reminds me, what was that? Was it called 15 Minutes? With Edward Burns and Robert De Niro. Did you ever see that, John, Amanda, either one of you?
I don't think I saw that.
Oh. Sounds familiar.
I don't know.
Sing me a few bars.
Robert De Niro's a cop and Edward Burns is a cop, and they're after this killer that's trying to get 15 minutes of fame. And then Robert De Niro, spoiler alert, dies halfway through the movie. It's just like a totally shocking revelation. It's like, what? How did that just happen? And then Edward Burns tries to carry the rest of the movie and it didn't work out. Sorry, I total sidebar, but that's all I kept thinking. But like when you were talking about an action scene, is there anything that comes to mind immediately? Like you're talking like Raiders, like that action scene, or are you mean more of car chases and that sort of thing?
I mean, it could go either way. When I talk about action, one of my favorite examples is The Dark Knight. Mm. It was just an explosive introduction and you're like, oh, we're really getting things rolling here. And some of the things, they often have like a smaller unexpected piece to it. There's usually for me some witty dialogue that happens if it's not just all action. I'm big on that too. And yeah, those are the kind of things that work for me. Oh. But it's something where it's just different. It just makes it stand out somehow. It's not just, okay, we're gonna, especially like 90s and 2000s movies, where the intros were always like the title sequence was rolling while they hover the camera in an aerial shot over like the ocean or trees or something. And they're like, oh, we're just going to pan over all of this. And this is our scenery shot. And it's like, okay, great. Very cool, I guess.
Boring.
You get something weird and kind of slow, but also action-y at the same time, like Mad Max Fury Road.
Oh, that's good. Or even tying into my Lethal Weapon 2, that freaking opening.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What a great opening with that car chase. And you get to reintroduce the characters, Riggs and Murtaugh, like you've never even left their side. I mean, that's the way you get people going. You start with action like that, man. I am in.
You know, solid openings to me are something that it's a promise they're making to you in the first few minutes of the movie. And then it becomes their job to fulfill on that promise, or at least set your expectations as to what you're going to be experiencing. Yeah. And if they land it pretty well, then you're going to be okay throughout the whole movie. And it doesn't necessarily have to be something where it's a action piece or a horror piece or any of these other ones. It just so happens that some of the better ones or some of the more fun ones or memorable ones just are action pieces or horror pieces.
I like that you reference the expectations, because sometimes I'll go into a movie and I won't really expect much from it. And mostly because I watch the trailer and I'm like, this doesn't really look like my kind of movie, but I'll go to the movie theater and watch it anyway. And then I sit down and experience that first 5 to 15 minutes, depending on how long their intro is. Some of those, you know, like Tarantino has one that's 14 minutes long or whatever. But
that feels right.
right. But when you sit down and you experience that and you're like, wow, okay, now my expectations have been raised. And a lot of times when they have that good of an intro, you get fulfilled, I feel like, more likely than not. And it makes you, I mean, it's really just about setting up what you're going to see. And in terms of your expectations, like you can expect this movie to be ballsy. You can expect this movie to be really funny, whatever it is.
Yeah, Reservoir Dogs does that wonderfully, where it sets up every character.
Oh, yeah.
In that opening scene at the diner. And you literally, you have a feel for every character by the time that scene's over, just by dialogue. Like there's no action, there's no nothing. It's just, it sets you up expectation-wise for the entire movie.
Goonies did it better.
Ooh, wow. Goonies did great, yeah. Good call.
You know, The idea that it's setting something up for you is pretty important to me, especially when it comes to a movie that I think about a lot when it comes to the opening is Battleship. Because
did you
I
say
watched
Battleship?
That movie. I said Battleship.
I did not expect this to come up during this conversation, but please entertain
all
us.
All right. So as long as I have the floor, you're going to go see a movie. This is when Hasbro is trying to put out their cinematic universe or whatever, and you got this movie comes out, and it's Battleship, and you're going, I don't know how these morons are going to put the movie together about, oh, look, B-15, you sank my battleship. How do you make that interesting? And so you sit down, and you watch a scruffy-headed, oh, God, what's his name?
Taylor Kitsch,
right. You have a scruffy-headed Taylor Kitsch, and you've got Alexander Skarsgård. I think that's Alexander Skarsgård. It's one of the Skarsgård. I don't know. That super tall Tarzan dude. It's him. You've got them at a bar, and then, he decides he's going to go to a convenience store to get a burrito for a girl.
Remember this.
And then...
That was fun. Yeah, it was fun.
And then they recreate, scene by scene... one of these dumbest criminals in history videos where you watch the guy break into the place and then he like falls through the ceiling and then he tries to climb back up through the hole he fell out of, but then he falls out of a different part of it. And it's scene by scene recreating like this world's dumbest criminals video. And from that point on, I was like, oh, it's going to be that kind of movie, and I'm okay with it. And I suddenly went from I'm expecting garbage to I'm just going to have fun and it's okay.
You know what? You won me over. I like Battleship, but I definitely wouldn't put it in the opening cinematic classics. But okay, you know what? That is a fun opening. I'll give you that.
Yeah,
I'm a huge fan of the obscure main character. Or obscuring the main character for a period of time. You know, Raiders, a lot of people call Raiders of the Lost Ark one of the best openings of all time, and I'm not going to dispute that, although I will, in a little bit, dispute which of the Indiana Jones actually has a better opening. That's my opinion. But it created this obscuring the main character thing, or at least that's the most prime. Well, actually, Jaws probably created it. But where you have an opening where you don't see a main character until after some things have already happened. So there's always this ominous build up to revealing the character because you don't really know who is this guy? Who is Indiana Jones? And works in Jaws. Who is Jaws? Dark Knight did it with Joker. Who is this guy robbing the bank? And then, you know, he flips up his mask at the very last second. After you're trying to figure out exactly what is going on? Like all these guys are getting killed and they're double crossing and triple crossing.
Right.
And who's the right guy? Inglorious Bastards did it with Shoshana hiding under the floorboards.
Good one.
You know, where you've got a wonderful opening scene and you don't even realize that one of the main characters has been under the floor this whole time and she's going to be very prominent, but not until much later. So I love when there's this tension or this anxiety and just want to see what's kind of already there. You know, what's being held out of our reach. You know, I mentioned Jaws because in the opening scene, the Jaws, another fantastic opening sequence. You never see Jaws. I mean, you don't see him for a lot of the movie, and especially the first half of the movie. But in that opening scene, everything you need to be terrified is in that opening sequence. Everything. And you never see, quote unquote, the main character. You never see the shark. You never see it. You don't even see it. I don't even think you see a fin in the opening sequence. You just see her go in the water and get pulled under and her screaming and going back and forth. Maybe you see a fin at that moment. I can't remember off the top of my head, even though I've seen it 1,000 times. But that is a perfect opening because it does what you just said, John. It sets everything up. It sets your expectations. It sets the table for what's to come.
You know, piggybacking off of that, I would say a lot of horror films or thrillers are able to do that too, because there's a lot of mystery behind who it is. And I would say the best for me that does it and the best intro personally is Scream.
Mm-hmm.
It's just so hard to beat that because it's,
I think I just beat it at least 3 times.
No, you didn't.
In that whole diatribe.
I'm pretty sure he did.
I'm just, off the top of my head, I think I did.
But the concept of a killer reaching out to their victim and trying to have this very witty dialogue with them and test them for their survival. And it gets very gruesome in the first 10 minutes, 5 minutes. and just that whole complete intro, and you still have no idea who is this person, why are they after her, what's going on, you know, and it's brutal, but it's shocking, but it leaves mystery. Like, they don't conclude what's going on right there, and that threads throughout the rest of the film. And to me, that's a great way to do an intro.
You know, I was going to save this for a movie that never lived up to the opening, but this is a perfect time to bring up. You bring up, I almost want to say Scary Movie, even though I know it's not a scary movie.
Yep, not that.
Different movie, different result.
It's a completely different movie. However, the movie that did it better than that, and almost to his detriment, was When a Stranger Calls.
Oh, and yes.
That's a good choice.
That's a great point.
That first, that scene with the phone call, that's the first 20 minutes of the movie, right?
Yeah, that's 20 yeah. minutes. That is
it's long.
Way better than anything that happens afterward. You're right.
Right. So it's, and that first 20 minutes of the movie, which is something I watched as a kid, stuck with me for, it still is a problem that I deal with. Like, my phone starts ringing, and even though I know if it's a cell phone, I'm like, someone's calling me from inside the house. It's like, it really bothers me. And, but then again, it's a movie that doesn't live up to its beginning, and it's all because that intro is just so powerful and it's so well done, and I think it does it better than I keep on wanting to say a Scary Movie.
Well, I mean, to be fair, that whole scene of Scream was a play on When a Stranger Calls. I mean, that whole movie itself is a nod to horror movies and some of the best horror movies. It's basically like reinventing the horror movie when the horror movie desperately needed to be reinvented. So it's a fantastic film, and the opening of Scream is wonderful. But When a Stranger Calls, if I had to pick an all-time favorite opening for a horror movie, that would probably take that over Scream. Actually, over Jaws, too. Because even though the movie, I think, is not great, like the movie itself, after that ends, the movie's kind of just okay at best. That opening terrified every kid that lived through that generation. I mean,
it's really the only selling point for getting people to watch it. You can tell someone, have you ever watched When a Stranger Calls? And then they're like, no. And then you say, okay, just go and YouTube the first 20 minutes.
Yeah, and then stop. You really don't need to watch anything
don't
else.
Don't go further.
Right. It's so well done. And I remember, John, the first time I saw that, I was watching some, you know, they had a lot of clip movies back in the 80s where they'd put clips of horror movies together. And I remember seeing that clip of just her taking the phone calls. I'm like, what is so cool about this? Like, they keep talking about what a wonderful scene this is. And I'm like, all she's doing is answering the phone. Okay, creepy guy on the phone. Ooh, who hasn't seen that? So I had to go rent that movie and watch the whole movie. Didn't like the movie. But that first 20 minutes, I was terrified. Absolutely terrified.
Yeah. I think they succeeded at doing a better job of it when they made the sequel, When a Stranger Calls Back. Because that whole movie is... As an entire movie is a lot scarier, but it takes that scene and makes it the majority of a movie in a way. They use a different mechanic behind it, but it works. It works almost just as well.
Well, there we're going to agree to disagree. I didn't like that movie at all. But
let me ask you guys about this type of intro, the type of film where it gives you one experience and it's super shocking, but it's not to say that it's the rest of the movie is bad, but it's just very different from the rest of the film. And it's just a way to mirror what's to come, but in a very different way. And I have an example in mind. I just am not sure if it's too soon for me to say it.
We're waiting with bated breath. Well, you know what? Let's go ahead and get to the stuff. That way you're talking about it in the right order.
Oh, we got to follow a list and procedures here.
No.
Sorry, I was just trying to have a conversation
Sorry
here.
Sorry for the discussion.
You're right, Amanda. You know what? Continue.
So, Midsommar, which came out last year, so I think it's on the one-year mark here, right?
Yeah, Midsommar.
But that intro, where they have that really, wow, brutal suicide.
Oh,
do you guys remember that intro?
Yes, that was intense.
Yeah, I never saw it.
Did you say, yeah, but I never saw it?
Yes, I did.
And it's not to say that it has no relevancy to the rest of the film, and it does. And I think it's a great intro, and I still loved the rest of the movie. But how do you feel about those types of intros where it's not like the same thing? It's not the same tone, I guess, in a way. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
when you talk about the rest of the film and that intro.
Well, I gotta be honest with you, man. I didn't like that movie, so I'm probably not the right audience for. I thought it went on too long, and it kind of forgot what kind of movie it wanted to be for a large portion of it. So I'm not a fan. I know you loved it.
And Aaron told me it's not for me. So yeah.
See, that's why you didn't watch it.
But I do think the opening was fantastic. I mean, so maybe I would agree with you. I like when that happens. I like a tone shift if the shift is going to be just as compelling. If you're going to make an opening like that, which is just riveting and pretty fantastic. And there's a couple scenes in that movie where I'm like, oh, that was cool. That was great. That was intense. But as a whole, it doesn't work. You know, then I like it less, because there's nothing worse than a fantastic opening where you feel like the rest of the movie didn't deliver. Like, that's a real struggle for me.
I kind of feel that way about A Clockwork Orange. You know, A Clockwork Orange starts with primary colors on the screen, very bright and vibrant versions of those primary colors on the screens, just to set you off a little bit. And then you go into the milk dispensary where they're sitting, and you have Andy McDowell or Malcolm McDowell. I can never tell them apart. Doing that.
Wow. One was in Hudson Hawk.
Doing that voiceover. And from that, I'm expecting a movie where you see a lot of the ultra violence. You see a lot of what goes on. But the movie takes a much slower turn after that, at least to me, and to what I was used to at the time that I watched it for the first time. So it was really a bit of a letdown as to what I was getting, because the opening was very much like, ooh, we're going to really mess with your endorphins and mess with your adrenaline glands and get you really pumped up to watch this. And then it kind of leads into this like fizzle that kind of like fizzes the entire time.
You know what? I get this piggybacking off of Kubrick. I get that with 2001, A Space Odyssey. The opening to that, I don't know if you guys have all seen 2001?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yep.
The Dawn of Man opening is amazing to me. As you watch, you know, apes get a little assistance from the stars. They learn to use a bone as a weapon. You've got that music that is breathtaking. I love the opening. It's unique. It's interesting. It's kind of setting up this whole, hey, look, what happens when it's kind of alluding to mankind. Once we realize we have a weapon, we start fighting for what we want. You know, that's just our nature. And then the movie just bored the hell out of me. For the rest of the movie, I just didn't care about much that happened on screen.
Hello, Aaron.
Just.
Now, with A Clockwork Orange, in some ways, I can agree. I felt like there's so much pause between, it's just like great moment, pause. It's not as fluid as I would have hoped for Clockwork Orange, but I still liked multiple other scenes in the film. But I can respect that it's something different. And I guess that's also an example. Well, not necessarily an example of what I was talking about, but there's certain things that if you do it right, it can be great. And if you don't, then it can make the rest of your movie not great at all.
If you start too high, and you can't keep that momentum going, you know, it can be a real problem.
And it's really hard to achieve that and sustain the momentum, but also just the fluidity of it. Like, I don't want to feel like I'm getting into a slumber halfway through the movie, and because I was on so much of an adrenaline kick for the first like 40 minutes. Mm-hmm. And so you have to, if you're going to do that, you better do it through the whole thing. And figure out
how to
do it.
You know what movie doesn't do that?
What's that?
Cannonball Run.
I like Cannonball Run, though. That's a fun movie.
Right. It's like, you know, it doesn't do that. It gives you this nice opening that it doesn't have really that much speaking to it. Nothing else. All you have is like this Lamborghini that's running through the desert, and all the crazy hijinks this Lamborghini. It's like Lamborghini itself as a character. And then you get into the rest of the movie where you meet the rest of the characters. But that's like a good 5 minute long intro to kind of get you in this party mood that kind of keeps going.
I feel like car movies that, if whether it's an intro or not, because one we haven't talked about is Drive, which had another great intro. And
oh, God, yeah.
It's really, I mean, it's fantastic. But they have so much benefit because you can move any scene. You can lift it up and build momentum and build interest just by having a car, because there's so many different things that you can do with it and the level of engagement with other people. I mean, I think about all of the Fast and Furious movies just to give you like an example. How they maintain that level of a high for their audience through the whole film is because they're introducing that all the time.
Yeah, they're starting with crazy and like, just wait, it's going to get crazier.
Yeah. But I mean, there's just something about it. And I'm not somebody who's like, oh, I love NASCAR, because I don't care. So it's not about the cars themselves. It's just such a great element and object to add to a film to boost it. And in an intro, I think it's always great.
You know, you were talking about intros that don't live up to the potential. I'm going to give you one. It might be a little controversial, okay? Because the movie is great. And I am acknowledging the movie is great. But the opening was never matched for me the rest of the film. Because, and I'll tell you the title in a second. I'm just hoping maybe you can guess it. But the opening is based on history. And it's so intense.
Cannonball Run 2.
Yes. No. It's so intense. It's so visceral. It's just one of those moments in film that is honestly very, very hard to top, because you're recreating things that really happened with actors, but you're doing it so well, so vividly, that it feels like we're
Saving Private Ryan. There.
Yes. Saving Private Ryan. The Normandy Beach scene, one of the most intense battle scenes I've ever seen, if not the. And I think a factor of why it doesn't work for the rest of the movies, because the rest of the movie's all, you know, primarily fiction, and we're just kind of going with them on a men on a mission, which is great. Don't get me wrong. I love that movie, but it never comes close to recapturing the beginning. Not throughout any moment in that film do I feel the same as I did on Normandy Beach, because it was just so intense and so chaotic. And so you're in the moment. You're with them on that beach the whole time, trying to survive. Like, how are we going to get out of this? You feel like you're part of the team. And it's just, it's a remarkable achievement in film. And it never comes close to that throughout the rest of the movie. It's still a great movie. Doesn't mean the movie's anything less than great. Just that opening is way better than the rest.
You know, one that this reminds me of in a similar way, but I think it's not as heightened in the beginning, but it at least makes you feel like you're part of this war with a soldier. And I feel like this movie maintained their momentum throughout, and it didn't let me down, was American Sniper. And I referenced it earlier. When he has to make that executive decision whether he's going to shoot a child or not. And you have to place yourself in there. You're like, whoa, man, like, that's a kid. But then you think about it. You hear it. You see his reaction, and you see how he has to make the decision who's going to live or die. And you feel that through the rest of the film, because it really sets you up for that. And it's not as, I don't want to say, it's not as compelling as Saving Private Ryan in any capacity, but it still places you there.
No, that's great.
And I think it's such a powerful intro to, especially for, you know, you to, in some form, a regular citizen, a non-military citizen, to be able to somehow place themselves in a situation like that.
Can you imagine if that kid would have been a plastic baby? It would have taken all the sting out of
that. Oh my God, the plastic baby! That's a real flaw.
That's a fun little Google tidbit right there. Go Google American Sniper plastic baby if you hadn't heard that.
Oh my God, it was so funny.
The ones that, anything left that stands out for you and why?
The one that sticks out to me a lot, and it's just a hard way to open a movie, but it's just so heartfelt as well, is the first couple minutes of Up.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, you know, you're watching it. It's great. It's fun. And then why am I crying first 10 minutes into a movie? This is bullshit. And then the whole movie manages to maintain that a feeling of not the crying, but a feeling of joy that it started with, or at least you're it kind of breaks your heart and then makes you fall in love with it again. And but that first like 5-10 minutes is hard to watch, but only because like I'm not supposed to cry that hard.
They really make you connect with those characters, and you're like, oh my gosh, how sweet. And then the tragedy happens where your heart is literally ripped from your body. And then somehow they kind of like place it back in after, you know, they put the pieces back together and stuff
after
and put
they
it back in.
Literally ripped it out of your heart?
Yep. They literally ripped it out. They chopped it into pieces.
Duct taped it back together. Got it.
Duct tape. Yep, I like that better. Okay. And then they said, here you go. We'll give you this bit back.
Literally. That's crazy.
Literally. I love it.
Okay. What was you said you had another one or no?
Yeah, I have a couple. One of them is just, it's just like a very comedic one to me. And it's Bring It On. I love that intro. It's the dream sequence where she's doing the cheer and then she ends up naked. And it's her having a nightmare about her reality. And that cheer is iconic at this point. And I just love that it's so honest. It's brutally honest, even in the lyrics of the cheer. But it's something that we've all kind of experienced. And you're in that moment and you think it's all really happening. And this is one of the few dream sequences that I think works exceptionally well. And then she's naked and you're like, oh, my God. And then you realize, oh, that didn't happen. No fans.
I don't remember that opening. I'm not a big Bring It On guy.
Never saw it.
You never saw Bring It On?
Nope, not my thing.
I mean, I saw it. I just don't remember the opening. But to be fair, I'm not a big fan of dream sequences. So I usually tune in.
Red hair. The boys all love to stare.
What just happened? I'm going to tell you one. Okay, since you're bringing in music, I guess. I'm going to try to connect the dots and bring this in here. Here's one of my favorite openings of all time, right? Of all time, of any movie. It is, in my opinion, my favorite character introduction for any superhero. Anybody want to take a guess?
That has music?
Yes.
Oh.
Is it Deadpool? Does he have music?
No, it's Guardians of the Galaxy.
My God, duh.
No, neither
they
one.
They have music?
Neither one. Blade.
Oh, that's a great one.
That is underappreciated opening where you've got Wesley Snipes. The music, I love that techno music. It just fits perfect. Mm-hmm. They're in the club. The blood's everywhere. And then he just shows up and he does that Wesley Snipes smile. And he's just like, oh, I'm ready. And you're introduced to one of the most badass comic book characters in film history. It's just, oh, God. I love that opening. And every time I see it, I smile the whole time.
That's a great choice. I appreciate it.
That's what I was going with. I was going with appreciation. What was your other one? You said you had one more, Amanda, you want to mention.
Yeah, Lord of the Rings. And the first one is my favorite of the trilogy. I feel like it's the one that's most put together and most engaging. And I love that for whatever reason, this would normally not be my type of film. It's realistically, it's not.
Okay.
And somehow, because of the way that they, I don't know if it's the voice, it could be the voice, I do love the voice, but the way that they're doing this narration intro with like flashback to history, it made me like connect with it in a very weird way. And normally I don't like this, just kind of like a, there's a word for it and people use it, but it's where they explain everything.
Exposition.
Thank you. I normally don't like that as an intro because I feel like it's such a cheap and lazy way to do it. Mm-hmm. Like just naturally give it to me. But I appreciated it in Lord of the Rings in a way that I have not appreciated that with. I can't think of any others.
You that need did that history much. For that to really click. I think.
You do. Yeah. You do. Yeah.
I'll give you one. This is one of my I've got a couple favorites. And this is one of my all time favorites that not enough people talk about. Dirty Harry. The opening to Dirty Harry with Clint Eastwood, and there's a bank getting robbed, and he's just hanging out, chilling, trying to suck down a hot dog. And he just pulls out his gun, and he's just shooting. Then he gets to the bank robber, he's like, I know what you're thinking, punk. Five shots or six shots, or only five. Do you feel lucky? And it's just one of those just iconic film moments where, and he's like, I gotta know. And then he goes ahead and just pulls the trigger. I'm like, ah! And, you know, I just love that opening. I freaking love that opening. Star Wars is another great example. You know,
oh, of course.
And it feels like it's this low hanging fruit, but how do you not mention it? That opening really sets everything in motion and keeps you engaged and keeps you. John, I would think you'd be. I'm surprised that wouldn't be on your list because Star Wars is one of your favorites. You got a tattoo of Star Wars and stuff.
Well, it's one of those. I mean, I kind of figure it is low hanging fruit for one, but also, I. you know, I know we're going to eventually talk about what our listeners had to say, and I assumed it was going to be in there at some point. But yeah, it's a fantastic opening, and it's like, again, one of the best openings of cinematic history is done with Star Wars. And I think all three of the original movies have fantastic, strong openings for what they do.
Oh, Return of the Jedi with the Jabba the Hutt, and you just got everybody mm-hmm. being reintroduced. That was great. That was great. Here's what I wanted to talk about when I was talking earlier about Raiders of the Lost Ark. A lot of people say that that is the one of the best, if not the best opening for a film of all time. And I'm not going to dispute that, but it's not my favorite, because Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom has my favorite opening, because I just, from start to finish, it feels like 15, 20 minutes of just nonstop action. You know, Indy's in the club, he's getting the diamond, he gets poisoned, then he's running around, he's trying to get the antidote, and then he's out the window, and then he's on a plane, and the plane, they jump out the plane with a raft, and the raft goes flying down, and they go down a ravine. Da, da, da. It's just like bam, 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 bam. It's just so exciting to me. And I've seen it freaking 200 times. Love, love, love that opening sequence.
That's one of the best opening sequences too. Whew. Love it.
Love it. Love it. Okay, and there's last one I want to mention, and then we can go to listeners. There's a movie called DOA. It's one of my favorites. It stars Dennis Quaid. It's a remake of a 50s movie. Most people haven't seen it. Those people that have seen it probably don't like it. It's not really a well-appreciated movie. I love it for my own reasons. But it's shot in black and white and the front and back. It's bookended in black and white. You know, and it's kind of... Casino Royale is another really good example of using black and white to introduce a story. But I love how DOA does it. It's very stylized. And what it does is it has Dennis Quaid's character kind of setting everything up by sitting down with cops, and he's there to report a murder. And then we come to find out it's his own. Bam, I'm here to report my own murder. It just sets the entire movie up and what's to come. And I love the stylized look of it. It just, everything about it feels really cool and mysterious to me. I just love that opening.
I have to actually sit down and rewatch that one. It has been decades since I've seen it, and I think I feel like it's a crime.
I love that movie.
Can I give you guys one opposite alternative?
Sure.
Like no. If like an opening that was not great and did not live up to how great the rest of the film was.
Well, we could probably do that with a box.
Absolutely not. It's not the homework assignment.
Inception. Because I thought about movies that I really, really enjoyed and that had a clever intro, and I rewatched that intro and it's so lame and boring. I mean, it's granted it's only like 30 seconds, 40 seconds, but it's just it's the beach where he shows up on the shore. You hear the ocean waves and you see the ocean waves. That's the intro. I was like, well, that's kind of lame. It doesn't get me excited. I just thought it was interesting that there are some movies out there that are really well done and just didn't put much effort into the beginning.
Right. So not only could you not follow the homework assignment, but you couldn't come up with a better example.
You didn't like my example? How rude.
Okay, I'll give you two more to take away that do fit. The Matrix, Carrie Ann Moss, when we're introduced to her, that's just a fantastic introduction. And one that's kind of forgotten, The Warriors. I mean, I don't know, Amanda, if you've seen that, because that's an old movie.
Nope.
But it's basically, it's the opening where you get all these gangs coming together, and you kind of, all the pieces are being put together in that opening. And it's just something, I think it's Walter Hill, just a great opening to a movie.
You're saying an old movie that came out in 79? That's not an old movie.
Oh, don't say that like you knew what year it came out.
I just
say it like
looked it up. But I'm like, exactly. I'm like, how old is this movie that he's going to say, this is so old, you'll have never seen it?
I think it's older than you.
It is, but how many movies do you love and watch that came out before you were born? Rear Window.
There's most of them were around when I was around, and even those are really old. So, you know, Jaws was around, I think, came out right after I was born, and that's old.
I don't think those are old. I think those, no.
Okay, less young.
Wait.
how's that?
All right, you know what? Pull out the little Google machine. When did Jaws get released?
75.
Jaws was in the, yeah, I was going to say.
So Jaws was 75, and when did you say?
79.
You just said 79. So Jaws isn't that old, but Warriors is.
No, I was saying that those movies aren't old.
Yeah,
he said,
you're actually yelling at me.
This is an old movie.
You're actually yelling at me. I'm just letting you know.
I don't know who I'm yelling at anymore.
Let's go to listener comments. What do the listeners think about the greatest cinematic scene? Anything that we haven't talked about already?
There's a lot of them that Brian Lowry brought in, and he's got a ton that I just adore. So he mentions Fallen, which has one of the greatest openings. Yeah, this is the story about the time I almost died.
Oh, I love that.
Such a great opening. Love it. Sets up a fantastic movie, and you have no idea what's going on. Usual Suspects.
Before you jump to fly to the next thing. Fallen, the reason why that one is so beautiful is because it plays with your expectations. Because the whole time you're thinking the movie's, you're thinking that narrator is going one way. And at the end, it isn't until the very end of the movie, you're like, oh, that's not who I thought it was at all.
Right.
Right.
That's why it's so beautiful.
Absolutely beautiful. He moves on to talk about Usual Suspects, the Hello Kaiser moment.
Mm-hmm.
Good one.
And then he also talks about Snatch, What Do I Know About Diamonds? Again, all three movies. But the one that he brought up that I really enjoyed, and it's a more recent one that it fits pretty well in the subject line, is the first 5 minutes of Baby Driver. It doesn't fit the rest of the movie in the sense of what the kind of story it's telling, because, you know, it ends up being a story about redemption, but it sets you up with this whole just a high stakes race through Atlanta that's a lot of fun to watch.
Baby Driver had great intro, good movie, great soundtrack.
I love that. The whole soundtrack, man. I still run to half those songs.
Yeah.
So good.
No, it's such a good soundtrack. So Vinny Schwartz says that The Invisible Man has one of the most suffocating and intense openings of recent times. And he is absolutely right. It's that whole first 15 minutes sets up that movie for you.
It was great.
Is it really even 15 minutes? It feels like it's just like 5 or 10, but it feels like it just goes on because it's so intense. You're just so engrossed in the moment.
Suffocating is the perfect word for it, because that's exactly how it felt watching it.
It was hard, man. It was hard to watch. Yeah.
So Angela Wallach said, best opening sequence for me is Guardians of the Galaxy. Now I will be singing Come and Get Your Love all day.
Actually, both those movies have pretty awesome openings.
They do. Yeah. Well, I mean, the incorporation of music into it, and it's very fun and stylistic and beautiful in terms of the color palette that they're using. It's a really great intro. They're fun.
Yeah, but the second movie had Groot dancing, and that was...
That's right. That one's real cute. I think I remember my entire theater going, oh.
I like that opening, I think, better than the first movie, personally. Hmm. What else?
She also made mention of Up and how sad it was, which I think we've touched on a little bit. Sean Coates, he says, I'm going to pick Drive, starring Ryan Gosling, the opening sequence of how he creatively is able to evade police with a car full of bank robbers and establishes right away what an expert he is at his profession, all before the credits roll.
Yeah, I really dig that movie.
Brilliant.
I really dig that movie too. And what I love about that car chase, it's one of the slowest, most deliberate car chases you see on screen.
Yeah. I mean, just Ryan Gosling's demeanor in that seat is beyond. I mean, yeah.
He's so cool in that movie. Just absolutely.
Okay. All right.
Easy. Yeah.
Calm it down.
I'm gonna rip through a couple.
Both of you.
I'm going to rip through a couple of these that we haven't talked about. I'm not going to mention anything we've already talked about, but Josh Dima, I love the opening sequence to Watchmen. It throws you into this hyper stylized world with this great fight scene soaked in mystery. It showed you the tone and basic palette without giving you all the details and what was going to be hidden behind the rest of the curtain. Instant attention, curiosity grabber. That's exactly what a great film opening should do. Yeah, I would agree with that. It's a fantastic
Yeah, definitely.
Peter Dennis, Do the Right Thing and Rosie Perez dancing to fight the power is utterly mesmerizing. That's a great one. Michael Bonovich, Deadpool, playing Angel in the Morning, camera panning around, freeze framed in a car full of people in the process of being in a terrible wreck. That's a wonderful opening and completely Deadpool. You know, you got to use your imagination to figure out what the hell is going on. And Stefan Smidebeck said The Villainous opening sequence. Now, I don't know if you guys have seen The Villainous. Wonderful movie. The opening is insane.
You know one I'm surprised, Aaron, you didn't mention with how often you watch it? The Hateful Eight. The carriage and the white blizzard. And To me,
I did reference a couple Tarantino movies. I think Hateful Eight, I love the movie as a whole. I don't think that opening is powerful. Pulp Fiction, I mean, it's great. Don't get me wrong. I love, especially as you meet the characters, you're meeting Samuel L. Jackson, you're meeting Walton Goggins, and the conversations are wonderful. but they don't compare to Reservoir Dogs, Pulp Fiction, Inglourious Basterds.
Agreed. Yeah. I was just kind of surprised you didn't mention it, but that makes sense.
Well, I mean, how am I going to mention? I mean, I can mention Kill Bill, the opening with Kill Bill, where she just...
Honestly, all of it, yeah. All of his movies.
Tarantino knows how to get you into a movie, man.
He does. He
really does. God, now I got to watch that fight between her and Vivica. Hey, Fox, that's just an awesome fight. A couple more. Ricky Milan says Hostiles from Scott Cooper.
Mm.
That's an interesting... I don't love that movie, but I do like the opening a lot. And Barbara Harris, the Bond movie opening scenes are guaranteed to please, which is a good point. All the Bond movies.
That is a really good point.
They're built for opening sequences.
They are. Mm-hmm.
Oof, that was a fun topic, man. And you know what we're going to talk about next week? Do you want to know?
No.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
I would like to prepare.
Next week, we're going to have... I think Trey Heinrichs is going to pop back on. And we're going to have a movie battle royale, and it's going to be the summer franchise edition. So we're basically going to pick from the year 2000 to now. We're going to try to pick our 8 most favorite summer franchises. We'll definitely put a poll up in the Hollywood Outsider group. So definitely check that out. If you want to participate, you can vote on what that franchise might be. And we're going to decide what the best summer franchise is of the last 20 years. And I will tell you this, okay? I'm going to make this very clear. The MCU does not count as a franchise. We're breaking them up. They have to be separate. So Iron Man can be, Captain America can be, can't be together. We're just not doing it. You can do the Avengers.
I thought you were going to go maybe by the phases.
Nope.
Like phase one,
nope.
Two.
You can do Avengers. You can do that because that's, you know, its own thing. But we're not going to do MCU because I just feel like that's such a cheat. And that's all it'll be. Okay, MCU, done.
So by summer definition, we're talking what release dates, or are we talking
May 1st to August 31st, and you had to have at least 3 movies in the span of that 20 years.
Yeah, this isn't like the music one where I thought it was only summer music.
I just thought I would clarify for you, John, without calling you out, because that was rough.
Because I could have been like, you know what? Screw it. I'm going to be picking Christmas movies.
if you like listening to Christmas songs in the summer, man, it could have been. Wasted opportunity. All right. Well, let's. Any recent newer film or TV recommendations we haven't previously talked about?
Can I give you an unrecommendation? Like something that is not worth your time?
Sure.
It's called 100 Humans, I believe, on Netflix. It's basically supposed to be where they're doing. I kind of want to relate it to like a reality show.
Social experiments.
Yes. They're so poorly developed. They are not scientific. All of the hosts have no credentials. It looks like the best description that is out there, and I am stealing this because it's so perfect, is that it basically looks like a show that would be on Spike TV if it weren't on Netflix. It's rough.
That's accurate.
Watched it?
No, okay. I'll walk past the room as the other person in my house was watching it.
My God, how can you get through a whole episode without cringing?
It's not for me.
It's not for anyone, realistically.
All right, John, you got any real recommendations?
Real recommendations. Well, I just recently sat down and rewatched Band of Brothers, and especially considering the times that we're in, I needed something that made me feel like there's hope out there. And oddly enough, Band of Brothers was something that made me feel that hopeful. So if you need something to remind you of why everyone's fighting for all the right things that they would need, that's a good thing to sit down and watch and feel good about.
That's a good one.
I think I said that right.
Yeah.
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 I did finally finish Schitt's Creek. It's something I did mention that I started watching and I started liking. I adore that show. There's not enough ways I can say that that's one of the best crafted short for form TV shows you can find out there. And the fact that they did 6 seasons and done, and the way they ended it, I adore that show. If you ever get a chance to see it, Netflix has the first 5 seasons. The 6th one is floating around out there somewhere. You should sit down and watch it. It's a lot of fun. And you start off with a family of people who are really hard to like, and they become people that you really start rooting for and love and appreciate and like just adore for all the right reasons. It's just great.
Mm-hmm.
Very cool. So I watched Luther, which is about John Luther, Idris Elba, that's his BBC TV show. I've heard about it for years. I watched one episode before and I just couldn't get into it. So I'm like, I want to try this again because I just watched all the seasons of Bosch and I love Bosch. So I was in this flawed hero kind of kick and threw that in there. And man, you know, I've always liked Idris Elba. I haven't loved Idris Elba as much as a lot of people have. I just feel like a lot of the times in movies, he's the same guy. Here, I really want more roles like this for him. He's just magnetic, like absolutely magnetic. And he's a cop. He's obviously flawed. He's manic. He's obsessive. He's a lot of things. But man, he goes from zero to rage in a matter of seconds. And he's just so intense and interesting to watch. And he ends up wrapped up in a relationship with this. And it's an odd relationship. I can't even explain it. But it's this relationship with a sociopath named Alice, who's played by Ruth Wilson, who is perfect in the role. And those two just play off each other so well. It's just a show that I'm growing to love. I've already finished like three seasons of it. I think there's two more. They're all on Amazon Prime. So if you've never seen Luther, give it a shot.
That one sounds really good. And I'm glad to hear Bosch lived up to your expectations, man, through the end.
Bosch is great. I love that show. He's such a like me character in many ways. So it's maybe that's why people kept recommending it, because he's very much, I don't have time for your nonsense. Like, you're just being ridiculous. He's me without jokes. And, but
it doesn't sound as fun.
Well, I mean, he's definitely not as fun, but I just like his attitude. You know, when people, he just doesn't want to have to do the BS. He just wants to, you know, go forward, answer your question. Why do I got to appease you? You know, I'm just trying to be straightforward. I just want to get to the point. You know, I'm just here to do what I'm supposed to do. That's it. That's my job. You know, and I love that aspect of it. So it was a show I really, really just loved.
No, Bosch is a great show.
I do have a real recommendation. I finally got around to watching Just Mercy, which is free right now on pretty much every platform. I think even Redbox has it for free.
Yeah, they gave that one and Selma, I think, are free for the month of June for rental.
Yeah. Awesome. And I really liked it. I think it lived up to my expectations that I had for it. It made me cry. Not as hard as I did, though, rewatching The Hate U Give. That one is just so powerful coming from, I think, a kid's perspective.
It's a better movie.
Makes it. I mean, there are elements that are better, too, but the stories are both insanely powerful and just bring you to tears and crush your heart a little bit. But the ending of The Hate U Give just every time just makes me bawl my eyes out. There's multiple moments. So both of those I would highly recommend watching.
And actually The Hate U Give, which is a fantastic movie, my number two movie of 2018, I believe, is also free for rent in June.
Not related to that, but we're on 2 weeks now of HBO Max being out.
Oh, yeah. God, I forgot about that.
Yeah. Do we have thoughts on it?
Okay, here are my thoughts. I've got a few. One, have some original content if you're going to launch. I just feel like there should be a little bit more than what there was, personally. But the Looney Tunes cartoons are freaking awesome. And they hit the mark of what they needed to be to make my giddy bones go giddier.
Yeah, I've been going to that for Looney Tunes cartoons a lot. I watch a lot of the other content they have too. Anna Kendrick's new show is actually worth sitting down and watch. I watched the first two or three episodes of it. I haven't gone back to it since the first time I sat down with it, but that show has a lot of things that I like going on for it. And it's Anna Kendrick. She's charming and she's fun to watch.
The movies are pretty good too. Like there's
quite
a few movies. The only thing that bums me out is that all of DC's catalog is not on there. And the ones that are on there, a lot of them are going to go away. And that's just weird to me since they're... Now, I realize that some of them are... They're licensed through Netflix and other streaming platforms right now. So that's why you won't see them on there. But then you have some of them that are actually on their DC Universe streaming platform. And it's just like, get your shit together, man.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's just ridiculous.
That part's a little disappointing. But I do like the integration with HBO, which, you know, when you go to each individual channel that you're integrated with, like Turner, is it Turner Classic Movies is on there?
Yes. I love that was there. I watched Casablanca my first day, HBO Max. Yep. First thing I watch is the oldest thing I could find.
Yep.
It's funny.
The integration with the different channels is actually really kind of nice. Cartoon Network, I went through a bunch of different shows on there. I don't know. I find that I'm going, like, I check Netflix first. If nothing catches my fancy, I go to HBO Max. And if nothing catches my fancy there, then I will go to the other things. I can't even remember the last time I launched Disney Plus, honestly.
I watch Running Wild with Bear Grylls. That's it. And Disney Plus. That's it. Man, but Amazon Prime, I've been watching the hell out of that. Between Bosch and Luther, I mean, I just feel like that's all I've had.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Doctor Who's on HBO Max. I've been having that going, too.
Nice.
So on that note, we're going to move right into the Ho Teachable Minute. And this time, it's going to be my turn to bring in something for the Ho Teachable Minute, which was because, and I did that all from the hip. Are you proud of me?
Yeah, I am. Wonderful.
All right. Here I go interrupting myself again. So because I watched Kevin James in that movie, Becky, and I fell in love with it, like, I didn't fall in love with his character, but I fell in love with his performance. I went down a rabbit hole on YouTube because it turns out Kevin James has a YouTube channel that he's been having a lot of fun with. And he's got a couple of different skits that he does. And one of them's the sound guy on a movie set where he throws himself into a movie and he edits himself into the movie as the sound guy. And they're hysterical.
The I Am Legend with Will Smith is one of them. That's pretty funny.
They're just all great. It's a lot of fun. So if you're looking for something that is fun to watch, and this is your Ho Teachable Minute, Kevin James is keeping himself busy through the quarantine by setting up these funny little videos that are like 2-3 minutes long a piece.
They're worth a giggle.
Yeah.
Share your thoughts on this episode or anything else in our Facebook group, The Hollywood Outsider. I do want to tell you, our 400th episode is coming up. If you would like to leave a voicemail and tell us what you think of the show or as a longtime fan, you can do so at 818-814-6246. That's 818-814-6246. Leave us a voicemail. Amanda said she'll do a compilation of all those and we'll play them during the show. So make sure you do that. 818-814-6246. Leave us a voicemail. Tell us what you think of The Hollywood Outsider. Brian and Scott will be joining us for that, and we definitely want to kind of have some fun. So we'll be doing that in 2 weeks, I believe.
Whoop, whoop.
And rate and subscribe us on your preferred podcast app. We're going to take off right now. You can find John's artwork on Insta and everywhere else at rjohndraws, Amanda on Veronica's Marshmallows and Smirk, and at Smirk into the, I'm sorry, and at Sink into This on Twitter, and me on The Blacklist Exposed presenting Hitchcock, and at Aaron Smirks. Okay, remember, guys, the next time you head to a theater, which reportedly will be July 17th for Tenet, and they can make all their money because basically every theater will just play Tenet, buy popcorn. It was nice. You know, we usually take a holiday week off, but we decided there's no summer movies, so we'll give ourselves an extra break because we've been... Oh, I'm going to change that. That's not the week for that joke.
Yep.
Pretty hard.
I'm glad you caught that because. Oh my God.
John, we can.
Are you going to like add this insert in, but none of the context of why John's dying?
I don't know. If there's an outtake, it'll be a bleep. Are you okay, man?
His veins are like popping out. Look at, watch his neck. Boom.
Okay. 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 I think I'm okay.
Okay. Oops.
Oh, man. Oh, he's out from a dying seal.
Jesus.